And the meeting has restarted also at 9:01. We'll do a quick roll call. Dr. King?
Present.
Dr. Castillo?
Here.
Mr. Leone?
Here.
Dr. Cornwell?
Here.
Mr. Greer? Mr. Barton?
Here.
Thank you.
Great. So we are hearing case number 2107, John De Ladasur, PTA. Board members and staff, let's take a moment to introduce yourselves.
Dr. King?
Yep. Oh, I'm Kelly King, the professional member.
Karen Bustillo, Vice President, Professional Member.
Mr. Leone?
Giovanni Leone.
He froze.
Giovanni, you froze.
We'll give him a second and come back. Dr. Cornwell?
Mark Cornwell, Professional Member.
Mr. Leone, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Giovanni Leone, professional member, secretary.
Mr. Barton?
Joshua Barton, public member.
Ms. Richardson?
Mindy Richardson, board investigator.
Ms. Cardoza?
Veronica Cardoza, administrative services officer.
Ms. Crowley?
Monica Crowley, licensing administrator.
And I'm Judy Chepius, executive director. And we also have Mr. Mark Harris, assistant attorney general.
Good morning.
Thank you. Mr. Ladasur, are you represented by someone today?
I don't know if he's online at the moment, but yes, I am.
I am, John. Yes, this is Nick Mesa with Worrells and Brady.
Good morning, Mr. Mesa.
And Dr. King, I see that Mr. David Checo, the complainant, has also joined the call.
Excellent. Okay. All right. So, Mr. Ladasur, do you want to make an opening statement?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I need to read something first. So this interview is being held persistent, of ARS 322046. The purpose of an informal hearing is to hear relevant facts by way of testimony and exhibits to determine if a violation of any of the board's statutes or rules has occurred. If the board finds a violation, it may take any of the following actions: issue a decree of censure, place restrictions on the licensee's practice, issue a civil penalty not to exceed $500, issue other disciplinary actions, issue a non-disciplinary order requiring completion of specific continuing education. If the board finds the violation or possible violation of statute or rule is not sufficiently serious to warrant action, the board may issue a non-disciplinary advisory letter. If the board finds that there is no violation of the board's statutes or rules, the case may be dismissed. If the board finds that the violation warrants potential suspension or revocation of the license or certificate, the board shall vote the matter to a formal hearing. At this time, I'd like to swear in the witnesses. Okay. Do each of you swear to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
This is Mindy Richardson. I do.
John, I do.
Perfect. Mr. Mesa?
As counsel?
No.
Are you? Okay. And then David Checkow?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
Thank you. Okay, so Mindy, you want to give us a, I just want to remind everyone to refer to the patient by initials as well, not his name. Okay, Mindy, you want to give us a summary?
Absolutely, thank you. Members of the board, this complaint was received from the employer at the time that Mr. Ladasur worked for Select Home Care. And they alleged that he documented treating a patient, DW, when the patient was off-site with a family member for a medical appointment. After he was approached about the discrepancy, he then removed his signature from the AM time and placed it on a PM time. There was no patient signature to verify the visit, and the facility logs have no documentation that Mr. Ladisser had signed in for that day. During the initial review following my interview with him, I obtained additional documents under subpoena from an employer he worked for as a contractor. So he was working at both Select Home Care and On-Call Therapy Associates at the same time when the complaint was filed. So I collectively put those documents together, and it revealed that the discrepancies identified in the original complaint were much more widespread, and there were discrepancies in billing and documentation that extended beyond that original complaint. You then heard this as an initial review at your regular session meeting in February, and you requested further investigation of Mr. Ladisser's documentation and his billing records. So the supplemental investigative report that I provided to you is in addition to the investigative report that I filed January 11th. The board should also consider those findings as well in your review of Mr. Ladisser's case. There were several key issues for the board to consider. This is a vulnerable patient population, elderly, homebound, and some with documented cognitive deficits. You may need to consider the community standard for an average daily number of home health visits. It generally is 7. Mr. Ladisser had documented up to 11 patient visits in one day. In my review, there were widespread inaccuracies in timekeeping for visits start and end time. In my supplemental investigative report, I completed a time study over a 2-day period where several patients had less than 10 minutes of available treatment time documented that could have been available. There's no documentation why the patient did not receive the expected 30 to 45 minutes of treatment per the plan of care. In addition, the truthfulness of what was recorded as treatment rendered is called into question when the visit was less than 10 minutes. In other words, the treatment Mr. Ladisser documented for these visits would have taken significantly more time to perform. And finally, there was a fair number of inaccuracies in the patient's documented residence and where the patient actually signed, the location where the patient signed. The board voted the following potential violations: ARS 3224045, engaging in the performance of substandard care by a physical therapist assistant, including exceeding the authority to perform tasks selected and delegated by the supervising licensee, regardless of whether actual injury to the patient is established. ARS 3224412, failure to adhere to the recognized standards of ethics of physical therapy profession, specifically 7D, physical therapist assistants shall ensure that the documentation for their interventions accurately reflects the nature and extent of the services provided. ARS 3224413, charging unreasonable or fraudulent fees for services performed or not performed. And ARS 3224414, making misleading, deceptive, untrue, or fraudulent representations in violation of this chapter or in the practice of the profession. That ends my briefing. This case is for your review.
Thank you. Mr. Ladisser, would you or your counsel like to make an opening statement?
Yeah, I would like to make an opening statement.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is John Ladisser, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to say a few words regarding the allegations made against me. It's been over 14 months since this investigation began. I've devoted a great deal of time to thinking about the allegations made in the complaint. Personally, this has been a very difficult and painful process. My intent has been to look at the issues honestly and challenge myself to be more accountable and take responsibility for my mistakes. As a result, I have committed to improving my record keeping and patient documentation. These changes were made well over a year ago and have become a permanent part of my daily routine. I feel good about this commitment and can promise you that the mistakes made will never happen again. I understand the allegations claim that I provided substandard care or charged unreasonable or fraudulent fees. My response is going to probably sound a bit simple, but I don't know of a more honest way to respond. It would never cross my mind to deny a patient the treatment that they deserve. Caring about a patient and providing proper treatment is, for me, by far the easiest part, being a physical therapy assistant, because of what I enjoy the most. Even on most difficult of days, I ensure that I take the time to treat my patients, and I would never cut a visit short so that I could rush off to the next appointment. Additionally, I would never under any circumstance charge a patient for treatment that I did not perform. I will take that statement one step further. I would never even allow myself to pretend or simulate that I performed a treatment so that I could benefit with any compensation. I want to assure you that I saw all the patients in question on the days as I recorded. My errors lie in my documentation, not in fraudulent intent. I've been practicing as a licensed PTA in Arizona for 10 years. I worked as home health PTA for 4 years. I've never been disciplined by the board or any other state board of physical therapy. And this is the first complaint filed against me. The allegations made against me are largely based on the time in and time out records reported for various patient visits. However, it has always been my understanding that home health visits and billing are not dependent on exact time entry. During my initial shadowing with a supervising physical therapist at Select, I asked about the question regarding the documenting for time in and time out. The supervising physical therapist told me that time in and time out entries are not billing requirements. He told me they're only needed to record time in and time out that reflected a 30 to 45 minute time frame in order for the software to function. Going forward, I proceeded with this understanding and believed that time in and time out notations were used only for internal purposes and as a function of the software. Consequently, my time entries were consistently recorded as a 45 minute therapy session. The only exception being instances where I would co-treat with another therapist. The software would not allow both of us to enter the same time frames. As a result, we would need to indicate different and shorter time frames to account for the treatment of the servant. This is yet another example of the inconsistencies between the software and billing requirements. In the 1.5 years that I was employed by Select, I consistently entered 45-minute time blocks for all my patients. I was never questioned about this practice, and as such, I did not consider it to be an issue. The investigative report heavily focuses on calculating my travel and treatment times and ultimately concludes that because my time in and time out notations overlap, this must mean I never saw a certain patient or that I inappropriately cut my visits short for personal gain. However, these conclusions do not accurately demonstrate the truth of the matter. As stated, I admit that I was estimating my visit time, and due to these estimates, there appears to be overlaps in the visits. Additionally, as some of you may know, practicing in home health space is unique and often means working with fragile patients and being sensitive to each patient's varying degrees of tolerance. Therefore, I acknowledge that I do not always spend a full 45 minutes with each patient if the patient's conditions do not allow it. Nevertheless, each visit was in fact conducted on the date recorded, just not always within the exact time frame. It's important to note I was never formally trained or instructed on the use of the record-keeping software or billing. Up until the complaint, I never received any feedback or criticism from my employer, Mr. Allen, or any other supervising physical therapist, suggesting that I was inappropriately documenting time in and time out entries for patient visit. Regarding the visit with patient DW on February 23rd, 2021, I understand that my documentation was not acceptable and can be interpreted as sloppy. I acknowledge that I originally entered the incorrect times for this visit. However, I maintain that I did treat patient DW in the afternoon on February 23rd, 2021, my handwritten notes that were taken on that day, and the documented vitals confirm this treatment. The reason this record, including the original signature, was deleted and subsequently corrected was because I had entered the wrong patient information in the wrong record. Once I recognized this error, which I believe occurred due to the change in the visit time, I contacted my supervisor. I was at, and I asked to be given access to the note to correct the information, which I was given. I never anticipated that this correction would be viewed as fraudulent behavior. In terms of my inadvertent failure to sign the logbook at patient AW's home, I'm not always asked or directed to a logbook when entering group homes. I now understand the importance of signing in, and since this issue came to light, I've made sure that I sign into all group homes. However, it is important to note that during Mr. Allen's interview with Ms. Richardson, he agreed with my statement and admitted himself to failing to always sign in and out of homes. In closing, I completely understand the importance of accurate and thorough documentation. I also understand that poor documentation without explanation may suggest fraudulent behavior. However, I never billed for a visit that I did not conduct. I now recognize the importance of documenting the proper times for each and every visit. I see that such entries can be used to substantiate and to cross-reference care that I provided. I ask the board to consider my 10 years of compliance and the explanations I provided during the investigation as it considers its next steps. Thank you again.
And members of the board, if I may add just a couple points. As you could tell, obviously, by John's statement, this has been an experience for him, and he's caused him a great deal of reflection. I do want to, again, though, emphasize a few points that were brought out in the investigation. We noted, again, that the change was made after the fact. There's never been any dispute about a record change made after the fact. In the investigative materials, it's also very clear that the change was made. It can't be done without an administrative approval, right? And John got that approval to make the modification after the discrepancy was, what he was notified of the discrepancy. So any conclusion that John deleted a signature is false. The signatures, as we understand it, are deleted anytime a modification to the record is made. Again, that modification was made because, as we contended from the start, the wrong information was put into the wrong patient profile. It's also really important to note that from day one, we've pointed to John's handwritten notes from the day in question as proof that these individuals were seen. Now, these notes, as we noted before, were completed contemporaneously with the patient visits on that day. And this board, again, understanding the importance of these notes, directed staff to review the records and compare the vitals that were written on the notes and the vitals that were entered into the patient records. And the conclusions there, I think, are really critical because there's a lot of other information that's floating around. But the conclusions in that review are that all of the vitals written in my handwritten notes were confirmed and corroborated by Ms. Richardson's review, including the vitals for patient DW and all other patients that John saw for select. So that's also a very critical thing, I think, to keep in mind as the board discusses this matter. Finally, John noted this, the start and stop times documented in the systems, again, were all approximations. I think John will be the first one to now tell you that he understands the critical mistake that was. But these approximations also explain the overlapping time and travel and treatment times of patients on those particular dates. John's also very clearly admitted that there are instances when patients are not seen for a full 45 minutes. So again, the calculations and approximations that have been made by Mrs. Richardson, I think, again, the overlapping times are explained by the fact that John oftentimes approximates that. And it's the understanding of us and John as well that this was really told to him as a factor and function of the software itself, that that's really all that mattered. So I ask the board, obviously, to continue, focus on these key facts. John obviously understands the importance and the accuracy of the record keeping. And really, this is a case, I think, of poor record keeping, not necessarily fraud or unethical conduct, because, again, the contemporaneous notes really do point to the fact that these patients were indeed seen, albeit the record keeping of those visits were less than perfect.
Thank you. We have Mr. Chacko on the call as well as the complainant. Mr. Chacko, would you like to make an opening statement?
Good morning, all. My name is David Chacko. I'm the administrator for Select Home Care based in Scottsdale and was John's employer at the time. The issue related to patient DW was brought forward by the supervising therapist, Mr. Allen. I want to say in March of 2021, I believe, was the time frame. John, sorry to see you again as far as in the session. That being said, one comment that Mr. LeDoucier and his counsel made that I'd like to make a comment to is related to the removal of signature. The only way that the removal of a signature can occur is through a clinician task item. So John, in question that date, had sent a message to our QA person, whose name was Julie at the time, to return the task, which is a routine item. As far as to return a task doesn't really require administrative approval. The signature was removed as far as by the clinician, and then the time it changed prior to the fact that Mr. Allen brought the complaint forward as far as to leadership here. So that's what kind of prompted us to actually focus on this, just from the standpoint of a task was returned, a change was made, and then a complaint was made by the supervising therapist. So we recognize that there's something going on. John chose to terminate his employment with us during the investigation. So we stopped as far as our investigation and forwarded it to the state, just from the standpoint of we recognize that there's something going on. The supervising therapist felt strongly enough to bring it forward. And the patient's advocate at the time, the patient was mentally compromised, as I understand it, denied the fact that the visit occurred at the time stated.
Thank you,
time is.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
To Mr. LeDoucier's point, the specific billing for that insurance is not time-based, but the Medicare standard is accuracy in reporting. So one of the data elements in accuracy from our perspective and from Medicare surveyor under DHS would be time on task. And that was confirmed with surveyor of the day, Shirley Hawkins, back in 2021. And again, during our survey in 2021, we reported as far as the complaint as a significant item during the survey period to Sharon Corbett with DHS.
Thank you. Okay, at this time, board members, do you have any questions at all for Mr. LeDoucier?
This is Mark Cornwell. I have a few questions, a couple. So if the software required you to put 45 minutes in there, what would I'm assuming that that would the software uses that to know whether or not a full charge can be made to Medicare, correct? John,
are you directing to me?
Yeah, John.
Mm-hmm. I only understood that there was a time block. I as far as picking the 45 minutes, that was just a choice that I made because I had heard you need to pick a time block someplace between 30 to 45 minutes. So, and I also knew that the billing was done per visit and had nothing to do with the minutes that were spent with the patient.
But if you only spent 10 minutes with the patient, would they still be charged?
Yes.
For the full
as
amount?
As my understanding, we were allowed to do what was called a health check. If the patient had very little tolerance, we could put eyes on the patient, get vitals, and spend some time doing patient education.
That doesn't ring right to me, that if you don't institute much of a treatment, how can you charge for a treatment?
I'm just going by what my understanding was.
Okay. So if you were only with the patient for 30 minutes, did you put 30 minutes in the software?
No, I tried to keep a 45 minute block. I was consistent with that from the day first I started with the company.
Help me understand why that would be better to be consistent rather than putting in what you actually spent. Why is that better?
Well, in my understanding, the amount of time that was spent with the patient wasn't a requirement. And so I'm only putting in a time block for just what I understood is how the software functioned.
Okay. And so you saw quite a few patients during the day, right? More than seven, sometimes up to 11 in a day.
This was an unusual week. It had been very slow with Select for quite a while. And one of the supervisors gave us permission, a couple of us, to go ahead and see if we could get some additional PRN work. And so what happened was the PRN work and Select became a little bit busier for us. So that's why, you know, that during that period of time, it jumped up to a higher patient load.
Well, even when would you start work? Typically,
it could be as early as 8 o'clock.
When would you quit? Typically,
sometimes 5, sometimes 5:30.
Okay. So you got 9 hours. I'm assuming you took a lunch.
If I was really busy, I wouldn't.
Okay. And so that's a really tight schedule. If you're seeing everybody for 45 minutes and then there's travel time, how do you get that many patients in?
Well, as we had noted, a lot of patients cannot be seen for 45 minutes. They just don't have the tolerance.
Yeah. Here's my problem. To me, it appears that they may not be able to tolerate it, but you're charging them as if they do.
Yeah. And again, as my understanding, there is no charge to the patient. And my understanding was I wasn't charging. It was a per visit, not a time requirement. Well,
somebody's charged, right?
Yeah.
You're charging Medicare, correct? And you're putting that Medicare charge in under the name of the patient, correct?
Correct.
So that patient really is being charged.
Maybe there's somebody else
on the board that can help me understand this, because I'm really confused on how you can see somebody for less than, you know, I understand if there's a flat rate for every treatment, but there's got to be a criteria of when does it become a treatment that's billable and when it's not. So,
well,
is
what
it
we were what explained to us. I'm sorry.
Is it 15 minutes that's the minimum before you can charge for that visit, or is it 30
minutes?
I've
never been told what a minimum was. What had been stressed was that, keep in mind, you want to be compensated for your time. And if a patient doesn't have tolerance, you can do a health check. Get some eyes on the patient, make sure they're okay, get their vitals, and you can spend some time with patient education with them.
Well, how long would you spend doing that?
I don't have a record of the exact amount of time.
No. Okay. I'm going to remain confused for a while.
Dr. Cornwell, this is Mindy. I would maintain, too, that there is evidence to support that when he had visits that were less than, you know, 20 minutes, 15 minutes, 8 minutes in some cases, that his documentation was the same as the previous treatment. There was a lot of carry forward, as I noted in my investigative report. It did not reflect a health check. It reflected a treatment.
Okay. All right.
Mark, I'm with you on the confusion, and John, I just have a question. So let's say that your understanding was that you, as a PTA, following a plan of care written by a licensed PT that has goals, that you could do a health check, just take vitals, do some education, document that physical therapy was delivered to that patient. So I'm having a really hard time following that piece. And the second part that I really couldn't find in your documentation was any communication back to the supervising PT that on that date of service, the patient status didn't warrant that they were okay to do the actual plan of care. Maybe the status had changed. They weren't doing okay, as our state statutes require that you have to communicate any change of status, you know, or change in the intensity, which I'm suspecting that if they didn't tolerate a 45-minute session, as I identified most likely by evaluating PT, you changed the intensity for that day, but you didn't communicate back to the supervising PT that patient wasn't actually able to fulfill the expectations for plan of care that day. So tell me about your thought process on that and how frequently I couldn't find any communication back with the supervising PT. So how did you let the PT know that on any of these dates of service that the patient didn't tolerate what the PT would expect you to be able to do for that plan of care?
Yeah, first of all, let me say I admit my documentation was a bit sloppy in that aspect. As far as the communication with the PT was on a daily basis. So I was under supervision with a couple of different PTs during the time. And so communication with them would be daily. A lot of the PTs would ask me verbally about how a session went instead of taking the time to go look at the documentation, because we could cover several patients in a very short period of time. So if there was a period when a patient just had not been able to tolerate, it would have been verbally communicated. That would have been the case with them.
So we don't have any proof that that conversation happened then on any of these that were done, that were seen less than the expected amount of time.
Some of the communication was done on a secure messaging, the Tiger text, but I don't have access to that since I left the company.
This is Karen Bustillo. Just to piggyback on that thought a little bit more, if your documentation isn't changing from day to day to day, but you're doing these well checks instead of an actual treatment, if the therapist is supposed to read your documentation and it's not changing, how are you letting them know? Why is the therapist not going then back to do a reevaluation if this patient is not doing well?
The majority of the patients that we have with Select had only three visits. They would have one of the visits would be the evaluation. Then they were aware that the next treatment would be done by me. And then the third treatment that they were approved through their insurance would be the discharge. And many of the times was just see what they can tolerate. And that's because that was all that they could really tolerate was, you know, maybe just the health check. And it was aware, and many times the PT was aware of that initially. A lot of the communication about, let me tell you about the amount of time to spend with a patient had never once been communicated. But what had been communicated is do not make a patient feel rushed. Make sure you spend the time with them. But if they're fragile, do not exhaust them. I never had a complaint about either one of those.
Okay, I don't think that answered my question, but I kind of understand. I'm actually glad that Mr. Chacko is on this call with us today. This is the second month in a row that we have had significant concerns about select billing practices. Unfortunately, there's really not much we can do about that, but it's definitely peaked on my radar at this point. I'm still really as confused, I think, as when I started this discussion today. I just really feel like this is just poor care, poor practice, and I do feel that everything that has been documented in the investigative report is real, and so I don't know what to do about that right this second, but I'm very concerned.
Yeah. Hey, it's David Chaco. May I ask a clarification question of what the concern is related to select home care? Historically, if we can't defend as far as the validity of an intervention or a treatment, we won't submit billing for that. That's what occurred in this case with patient DW. In this particular instance, the patient was seen for 5 visits. We have no control over insurance authorizations, but once we did identify a discrepancy in the defensibility of as far as the treatment, we notified the insurance, canceled the billing on that, as well as notified Board of PT.
And Madam Chair, members of the board, this is Mark Harris. I apologize for interrupting, and I very much appreciate Mr. Jacko's question. But I would just ask that the board focus on the information related to the informal hearing, and if it's appropriate, perhaps Ms. Chapius can have a follow-up conversation with Mr. Chaco to answer any questions that he may have regarding practices.
Yes, thank you.
And again, to the extent that Mr. Chaco's questions relate and help you better understand the facts of this case, feel free to respond and have a conversation regarding it. But if it's just a practice-related issue, I would ask that we just focus on the issues involving the informal hearing. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Harris, I will add, I can appreciate that, and I will add, though, that it is, I think, relevant to John's understanding of what he believed was appropriate as well. I would ask John if John could at least describe the training or processes that you may have had from your employers with respect to how you understood the billing, the scheduling process as well.
The only training that I received was I shadowed the supervising physical therapist at the time. And that consisted of 2 visits, 2 home visits. I know later on they did begin the practice of training some of the new therapists with the computer and going over how to use it, how to use the documentation, because one of those new therapists, I was asked if she could shadow me during my visits. And so that was the first time I had heard that they had started training. And that was soon before the resignation.
Thank you, Mr. Latasor. I think that it's important for us to know that while your understanding of and training of the software is one thing, and the unit's not necessarily being relevant to charges, I think the bigger piece for me is treatment that you delivered or did not deliver, yet documented that a PT session occurred and was billed when you in your own statement said that there were times when you only did a health check where you took vitals and provided some education, which based on CMS, we can't just bill for education. There has to be an activity involved in actually being a session. I think that's the bigger key for me.
I've actually heard the same message from 4 or 5 different companies that I had worked with, is that patient education, spending time with patient education is something that they could bill for.
Not in and only of itself, though. There has to be an activity related to as well as the education. You cannot just bill for education and count it as a session.
And I think, Dr. King, too, the assessment of the tolerance, I think, perhaps in John's mind, is part of that process.
Understood.
Right? Notwithstanding the fact that there's a time issue, and I think we understand that, and I don't think there's any dispute in the time, but the assessment of itself is also a critical component to that understanding.
Understood. I do want to come back to the fact that he is a PTA. He cannot make that assessment and make a decision necessarily on his own without communicating back to the supervising PT and the supervising PT being part of that discussion and that decision about changing the plan of care for that patient that day. So that is not within his purview, his practice act, what he can do on his own. And so that for me, other than the time stamps, for me going in, making an assessment, making a decision to change the intensity, what was delivered that day, and not involving the supervising PT for that patient, for every single patient that occurred on, is a much bigger deal in his practice as a PTA in the state of Arizona.
Understood, Dr. King. And John is testifying here under oath that he did relay that information. Again, we recognize the lapses in the documentation, but he is under oath here testifying that the PT did know that information.
The other thing is, in many times, I knew prior to going in that that could have been the case. And so I would have received basically permission to do it to that effect if that's all the patient could have tolerated. The information that you said, an activity has to be included in order for it to be billable, is the very first time, and I think would enlighten a lot of home health companies, because again, this is something I've heard multiple times, is a health check is a billable thing, as long as if you've gotten the vitals and then you spend some time with patient education.
I'm just having a really hard time finding out how a health check can be billed as physical therapy services. I just don't see it anywhere. I have one other question for you. Oh, shoot, I lost it. Oh, yes. So, all right. But you've said since this time, you've totally changed how you practice. You've totally changed how you do. Are you still working in the home health field?
I do some, yes.
Can you just tell me about how you're doing it now compared to how you did it when this complaint came about?
Well, I've realized that just in light, you know, by this coming to light, how important that time in, time out really is. Even if it isn't a billable thing, I understand how it's important to document those times that you've spent in there. The other thing that I've become much more, my documentation in general has improved immensely. And some of the things that we did cover as far as documenting, improve my documentation that relates to what specifically happened during the treatment. I also do document now any conversations that I've had with the physical therapist. In addition to that, I'm adamant about signing in and signing out of care homes now, even when they don't direct me to it. Some of them don't, it doesn't even exist. And I, you know, it's make them sign a notebook, anything.
Okay. Thank you. Board members, do you have any other questions for Mr. Ladasur?
I have one. Have you done any continuing education over the past year in the areas of documentation or patient care in a home health situation?
Yeah, there was. I did on the documentation. I just want, that's an interesting comment, because inside the, in that course, there wasn't anything that stated about the amount of time spent in there, but I did cover the documentation and with the home health care.
Ms. Gustillo, I think we also put that in our initial response. There are certificates in there. John, I believe there were two courses, one dealing with documentation and the other with fraud, waste, and abuse.
Thank you.
I have a question. Mr. Ladu, sir, we spend a lot of time just talking about the idea of, you know, doing a health check and providing, you know, some patient education, but I haven't necessarily heard anything specific as to like what kind of patient education was being done. Can you give a little bit of explanation on what exactly that would have entailed during any of those visits, you know, after you did your check of vitals, like what actual education was being provided?
A couple examples maybe. The patient has a lot of swelling and is sitting in a chair. So I may spend some time with telling them to get their feet elevated, work on ankle pumps, use their compression socks. Another example, maybe I could spend some time with them going over the exercises again, and perhaps when they're feeling better. Those are two that come to mind.
Okay. So when you would go in and see one of these patients for a session and you were making a determination that it wasn't reasonable to have them go through a full session, do you feel like the education you were providing was just for the sake of being able to provide something to them? Or were you actually looking at it as they were reasonable and necessary? Because that's really what Medicare is going to specify.
Yeah.
And that's also something within our practice act is that it needs to be reasonable and necessary services, not just for the sake of just being able to bill something. Would you say that that fits the description of what you were doing with each patient?
Well, I want to back up a little bit because many times it's not me making the determination. It's going to be coming from them, whether how much they are going to be able to tolerate. And at that point, after then, I may go over the remaining part of what program I was going to be doing with them, and it can be just education. Visually going over it with them is one example. And as I'd said before, sometimes it's just, it could be even point of calling 911, because they're, you know, we've come in, we've done a health check, we've gotten their vitals, it doesn't look good. We've called 911 then. Those are examples. I'm not talking about the day in particular.
Okay. And then but as far as, like that, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say on a day like, for example, if 911 was called, I've gotten the vitals. I've called 911 and, I called our office and they say, yeah, as long as you've documented the 911 call, you've had their vitals, it's billable.
And John, can you just clarify too, though, John? I mean, this is in accordance with the PT's plan, correct? I mean, that is governing your acts, right?
Yeah, there is a plan of care, and there are. It's not in typically in the plan of care in the home health. It may be as vague as work on lower extremity strengthening, balance. If they're home bound, work on bed mobility. It can be a very vague thing, but because we have a better communication through our secure Tiger Text, or as most of the times with the PTs, we'll call and go over their patients.
And John, based on that, the treatment was reasonable and necessary based on what was directed in the treatment plan.
Correct.
In any of the situations where you mentioned having to call, you know, emergency services or anything like that, and you've mentioned several times that you would communicate with the PT through Tiger Text, is that something that happened immediately as, you know, once services were called, you know, for any of those types of patients?
Those were immediate. Yeah, I typically would. If there were some instances with in their parameters that were already listed, like, for example, there are parameters for a regular person may have a high blood pressure, but this particular patient is known to have high blood pressure, so has different parameters from the physician. Sometimes those were immediate, not just Tiger text, but I would put a call into the physical therapist.
Okay. Thank you.
I always had a very good communication with all the therapists that I had been working under. And for the most part, every patient that I work with, I'm not going to say every patient enjoyed working with me, but in most cases, I always had really good feedback of how the patient felt working under my care.
Thank you. Do any members of the board have any further questions for John, or do you have any questions for Mr. Chacko with Select Medical?
I have an additional question for John. So mm-hmm. John, I'm looking through some of your documentation, and I think the thing that concerns me with the testimony you're giving here today is it doesn't seem to match with the records that we have. So, mm-hmm. for example, I'm looking at patient EH, right? And the timestamp for the patient you saw before him is at 8:41. It's a 30-minute drive to the location you provided service to him at. And there's no timestamp on his visit. But the next timestamp, which is another 30-minute drive away almost, is between 20 and 30 minutes away, is at 10:02. So there's maybe 15 minutes there for you to provide care to two different patients, unless I'm really bad at math, which is not outside the realm of possibility. And I'm looking at your documentation, and you're saying that you're providing active seated lower extremity exercises, you're providing ankle pumps, you're providing hip flex, you're providing curls, you're providing mini squats, you're providing active sit to stand for 10, 20 reps, bridging from a supine position. And I'm a pretty healthy person. I don't need physical therapy. I don't know that I could do all that in 10 to 15 minutes. So I guess the question that I have is, I mean, are you alleging that this what you're documenting wasn't actually what was happening? And if you are, then what's the point of this documentation?
I admit my documentation was lacking during that period of time. I was relying a lot on templates. And not really paying close enough attention to what I was putting down.
So,
but as I stated earlier, a lot of that is one of the main things that I have made corrections with.
I guess my concern is from a third-party perspective, if anybody was to look at these records, I mean, if what you're telling us is true, the impression that any provider is going to give from these records is that you're providing a lot of therapy that it doesn't sound like was actually happening. And if that's true, why shouldn't the board be really concerned about that?
Yeah, I guess I'm just going to repeat the same thing as I understood that my documentation was not always the most accurate, and it was one of the areas that I made big valuable changes to.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Chacko? I just have a quick question for you, Mr. Chacko, if you don't mind. What is the expectation that's communicated with your PTAs, your assistant personnel, not necessarily licensed PTs, on the number of visits and the time spent with patients in home health?
So that's a couple of part questions. So going back to when John was onboarded, it was less robust as far as training. So we've since tightened it up as an occurrence of what happened here with John. going back to training right now. So even during John's tenure with us, the load level number of visits per day assignment was set to, I believe John was at a 6 load level, so no more than 6 visits per day. Because realistically, anything above that, assuming a 45-minute to an hour treatment, plus travel time, you're going to be going beyond an 8-hour day, and that's not typically reasonable for most people. If they're in a more, and John, so the way we segment as far as the values into 15 geographic zones, so there's more dense zones, less dense zones. John, if memory serves, was covering South Scottsdale, Scottsdale into the East Valley. So that was a pretty large territory. So anything really above 6 as a KPI as per se would be not tenable. There were rudimentary visit note standards. They've since been as far as tightened as an outcome of this event, and just updated again most recently. There's a weekly therapy call that goes through as far as training and standards. Ms. Richardson actually had a chance to interview one of our therapy leads. I believe it was in January. We responded back as far as with clarity on what we train on as it relates to time and documentation. For clarification, as it relates to time and documentation, the billing is not time-based, but accuracy of data reporting for the service event occurring is related to the time and date of the event, and we use that for justification for medical necessity as well.
Thank you.
And Ms. King, I'll just point out the fact that there are a lot of obvious changes made after the fact, which I think goes back to our initial point about what John understood during his time there.
I think that Mr. Chacko, did you say though that while John was there, the expectation was no more than 6 visits a day?
That was, I believe, the KPI John was set at.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chacko, this is Mark Cornwell again. Could you help me? Did you communicate with the therapy staff that there was a minimum amount of time that they needed to spend with a patient actively working on the treatment plan before it constituted a charge?
At that point in time, yes. I believe we'd done a bit of a time study as it relates with both therapy and nursing, looking at just breaking down all the task events that would occur during a visit. I want to say at that point in time, I was looking between 32 and 35 minutes as the minimum, just to do a comprehensive assessment, to visit, treatment, that type of thing. If they were going to do a more robust exercise plan specific to therapy, it would probably go greater than 40 to 50 minutes. It would depend on what would occur during that treatment. As I'm not a physical therapist, I can't tell you what it would look like, but at a quick glance for DW for 223, the time on task looks to be about 42 minutes documented, and the amount of data and what occurred during that event doesn't seem to align to what is documented.
Okay. So the time in and out doesn't help you decide whether or not they've met that minimum 32 minutes or something. It's you looking at the documentation of what they did.
Both. So the time in and out would, as far as validate that an event occurred at that point in time, because without as far as a date, time, and documentation, we can't bill. And so, accuracy in reporting for that is going to be all required, right? So if the note's not accurate, we can't bill for it. If the time's not accurate, we can't bill for it. And if the date's not accurate, we can't bill for it. Because that would be Medicare fraud at that point.
Yeah. I guess that it just brings to mind about, you know, he always put in 45 minutes. So, I mean, that is used in part to decide whether or not a treatment charge is warranted. So
this specific visit for T23 was at 42 minutes. So I don't think there is consistency as far as in this accuracy in the statement that he always put in 45 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
if board members don't have any other questions, Mr. Lattister, would you like to make a closing statement?
I do not. I did not prepare a closing statement.
Okay. Mr. Chaco, do you would you like to make a closing statement?
Definitely appreciate everybody's time and attention. Our intention as an agency is to always give optimal care within the framework of each patient and be accurate as far as in our statements and in our billing.
Dr. King, I'll just add for John, our client, that, you know, certainly, as you can tell, he understands the grave nature of the accusations, the deficiencies in his record keeping. Again, would ask the board to consider everything here said today, in addition to John's almost decade-long time as a PTA, with no complaints from either an employer or anyone else to the board, as the board deliberates next steps.
Thank you.
I do have one comment to make on something that David had brought up about I don't always use a 45-minute time block. There are instances where we cannot put in a 45-minute time block. And this is, if there is another discipline in there, we have to alter that time. So other than keeping a consistency with, and I think even Mindy, you have that on the record of how I would block that out, 11:45, 11:45. And on and on. That is the only time that may vary is if it runs up against another therapist and I would get a pop-up to say I can't use those times. So, or if they are there while I'm there, then we have to collaborate times with each other and make adjustments. But other than that, my 45-minute times are on there.
John, if I can clarify, how are you co-treating with the clinician at the same time as this 42 minutes time slot?
I don't know if that's, are we cross-examining in this?
Yeah. Thank you. And Dr. King and members of the board, again, keep in mind, we're just hearing closing statements by really just Mr. Ladisor and his counsel at this point. And once that is done, the board can go into deliberations. Of course, if the board has any additional questions, they're certainly at liberty to ask them.
Thank you. Okay, at this time, I think we will, unless there's no other questions for Mr. Ladisor or Mr. Chaco, let's go into deliberations as a board. All right, discussion.
I mean, my main concern is definitely still a mix of the documentation as well as the actual treatment being provided to each patient. I know, you know, according to Mr. Ladus, there's been a lot of changes that have happened with the documentation. It's not something that I'm comfortable just, you know, taking the word for it and being good with it. I think that there definitely needs to be something in place as far as having records reviewed and seeing how that is looking over time, seeing that there is actually improvements being made. But I mean, in terms of patient safety with treatment, one of my biggest concerns is if all the documentation is the same stuff over and over again, and another therapist comes in to treat that patient, they're going to be under the impression that the patient was able to do all these different activities when really, you know, the visit before, potentially that patient's vitals were down and they were sent to the emergency room as he had mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that is a big concern for me when it comes to patient safety in regard to this. Another issue that I have in terms of the documentation here is just, it's very generalized when it comes to a lot of these exercises. You know, patient does a long arc quad for 10 to 20 reps. Well, what was it? Was it 10? Was it 20? That's information that the next therapist needs to be able to know so they know what that patient's tolerance is going to be.
Are we ready to like look at findings of fact?
Unless Mark, do you have some comments or concerns?
No, I've reconsidered. No, I think we can I have something to say, but I think it'll fit into one of the next categories. So findings of fact, I think.
Yeah, I do appreciate Mindy's supplemental investigation. I think it sheds a whole a much more broad light on what was actually occurring during this time. And I think it's a significant concern for me on multiple levels. So Karen, do you want to go ahead?
So make sure that I'm doing this correctly, please. I'd like to do the findings of fact as listed in the investigative report. And is that the ARS 32-20-44-5 with substandard care? The next would be ARS 32-20-44-12. I do believe there are ethical concerns. ARS 32-20-44-13. Because of all of the above, I do believe that there probably is some misrepresentation and fraudulent fee billing. And ARS 32-20-44-14, somewhat with misrepresentation of services presented.
And would those be the findings of fact in both the initial investigative report and the supplemental?
I think it was the supplemental that had the additional one.
Yeah, the 12 was in the.
As it added 12, yeah.
Yes, correct. But
did I miss one?
No, I just wanted to clarify that under ARS 20-44-5 in the supplemental report, I said see investigative report dated 1/11 for additional findings of fact.
Oh.
So I didn't reiterate the same findings of fact in 20-44-5 from the initial investigative report. So there were quite a few findings of fact in the initial investigative report that I just said in the supplemental, see those. So I don't know if you want to consider those as well.
Thank you for that. I do believe that they should all be contained if we need to list them all.
Yes, it was engaging. Yeah. It looks like there are in ARS 32-20-44-5 in the initial report, it looks like there are multiple bullet points. Okay. Okay. I second, well, I don't know, there's not a motion. So that's finding of facts. So to make, I have a motion to approve the finding of facts. Is that what we do, Mr. Harris?
Dr. King, members of the board, maybe we can take these one at a time. And okay. What I'm hearing, Dr. Bastillo, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're finding a violation of 32-20-44-5 for the reasons set forth both in the initial investigative report as well as the supplement. And maybe if it's okay with the board, we can take it one violation at a time to see where we are at the end.
Okay. All right, so I guess we'll move ARS 32-20-44-5, both in the initial investigative report as well as a supplemental investigative report.
Second. Any discussion?
Who did the second? Dr. King?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, call the vote.
I think Judy may be on mute.
Okay, Judy, you might be on mute. I can't see your face. Okay.
I'm on mute. My apologies. It's been moved and seconded to include finding of fact for ARS 32-20-44-5 for the reasons set forth in the investigative report as well as the supplemental investigative report. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Okay, let's go on to second finding of fact, ARS 32-2044-12, as outlined in the supplemental investigative report.
And specifically 7D, I think is what it states. Second. Any discussion? Okay, call the vote.
Just a point of clarity for 2044-12, is it reasons set forth in both the investigative as well as the supplemental, or were all of them listed in the supplemental?
All of them are listed in the supplemental. It was a new violation.
Okay, thank you. It's been moved and seconded to include finding the fact for ARS 32 for violation of ARS 32-2044-12 for the reasons set forth in the supplemental investigative report. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Okay, I'd like to add for finding of fact, ARS 32-2044-13, as outlined in both the initial and supplemental investigative reports.
King, second.
So on these particular violations, I wonder just for the board's consideration, it looks like our concern is mostly the charging for services that were, especially based on the testimony we've heard today, it sounds like they were not provided. I wonder if maybe we pull some of the findings of fact regarding the billing rates and the payments. Just out of concern that it may not be relevant. I don't know if other board members have differing feelings. That was my only concern on this one.
Josh, can you clarify that a little bit more? Like, what are you thinking?
Sure. So there are two findings of facts in the supplemental. The patients are billed $55 per visit regardless of the time this is spent, and allowed to serve receive 605 in payments and 409 in payments on 218 and 223. And I think given the testimony I've heard today and the investigation, it seems to me that the evidence thus far is that it's not that the fees were unreasonable, it's that the services were not performed. And so that my inclination would be to remove those and just keep the other findings of fact that these particular items, you know, these particular intensity and the treatment time was not sufficient to have billed.
Would that not constitute a fraudulent fee if I didn't provide services yet? No. I billed Medicare, you know, I billed for them.
I think they would. My question is, do we need to say how much they billed? Is that helpful to us, or does it matter?
Well, I don't think we know. Like, he was paid $55, but we don't know what Medicare was billed.
Right.
And I think all we know is it's a flat rate.
It's a flat rate.
They get billed for home health.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that rate would be. Does it say? I don't recall it saying.
No,
I know he was paid $55 an hour for each visit, whether it was 5 minutes or 45.
No, it wasn't indicated in the reports what was ultimately billed to Medicare.
And the only reason I'm asking for clarification is because if all he did was a blood pressure and some patient education and billed for the same visit, billed for a visit at the same rate of a 45-minute full-on therapeutic exercise activity. I'm just concerned that that's really not PT he's billing for.
Right. Right. And I think that's my concern is, you know, maybe we amend those two findings of fact and just say patients are billed per visit and Mr. Legisseur billed for treatments on the 18th and the 23rd that were either fraudulent or should not have been billed, something like that. I realize I'm being nitpicky here, but that was my only thing that I looked at that and I wondered if that was necessary for our findings.
I can agree that we don't need his pay rate in that line item by any means. That can be, I agree, you know, with your thought on that.
My only thing that I would bring up with the fraudulent fees is, and again, a lot of this is just based on his testimony as well, is it sounds like in his understanding, what he was doing was medically necessary. So I don't know if this statute, like, are we basing it on intent or are we basing it on just what we're seeing within the documentation? This is the one that I'm kind of iffy on, and I'm more likely thinking that the next statute that we're going to look at is probably more of a representation of what was going on as far as making misleading, deceptive, untrue, or fraudulent representations, not so much fraudulent billing. But that's more of where I'm kind of thinking right now.
I think my concern on this one is given the timing and the admissions we've heard and the testimony and the interviews, I think my concern is that there's significant evidence that at least the services that were billed for, meaning the therapy exercises and the therapy that is being identified in these notes that are being utilized for justification for billing Medicare, was not being provided, or at least in some of these circumstances it wasn't. And I think that's what makes me think there's a violation of 13 here. But I think in order to get to that, I think all we need to say is that patients were billed per visit and Mr. Ladisir billed for these visits. And we don't think that the care that was described was provided.
So it sounds like that's probably more captured in 2044-14 than more than anything.
Yeah. If you're misrepresenting your practice, then you're also not billing for it appropriately. So right. I would look to keep 13, but I do like Josh's edits to the statement.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second, I think. Is that right, Judy?
We do.
Okay. Did you want to amend that, Karen, to add these statements, or?
Well, I'd like to have Mr. Barton edit that statement to make it reflect what we're trying to say here.
Okay. Is the proper way to do that then to have our current motion withdrawn and to make a new motion with an edit? I believe that's correct, right?
It is. I think that would be the easiest way to address the deliberations of the board.
I will withdraw my motion.
Okay. And I would motion that we accept the findings of fact under ARS 32-2044 with the exception of editing the findings of fact showing the pay rates for the visits and the total payments for 218 and 223 to state patients were billed per visit, and Mr. Lusser billed for visits to patients on 218 and 223-21.
Second. Any discussion? Okay. Judy, we'll call the vote.
I may need some clarity on this one, so please bear with me.
Uh-huh.
The first motion was withdrawn by Dr. Bustillo. Dr. King, did you concur with withdrawing your second?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and so then. The new motion is moved and seconded actually, do we have a second? Mr. Barton, you made this new motion. We didn't get a second.
I think Dr. King did.
King seconded. Okay. Thank you. I apologize. So it's been moved and seconded to include findings of fact for ARS 32-2044-13 for the reasons set forth in the investigative report and supplemental investigative report, with the exception of editing the patients who were billed for visits. And my apologies, I lost it there. The patients were billed for visits and
I think we wanted to just specify that the patients were billed for flat rate visits, and then after that leave out any information regarding how much Mr. LaDuceur was paid per visit.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, so that's correct. The fine should be that patients were billed a flat rate, and Mr. LaDuceur billed for visits to patients on these aids. So those dates are the 18th and the 23rd of February.
Okay, so in effect, you're eliminating the specific dollar amounts.
Yeah, that's correct. The goal is to limit just the specific dollar amounts.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. So let me read that again. So it's been moved and seconded to include the findings of fact for ARS 32-2044-13 for the reasons set forth in the investigative report as well as the supplemental investigative report, with the exception of monetary amounts, saying that the patients were billed a flat rate for visits and Mr. LaDuceur was paid for visits on those dates. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay, thank you. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
And that motion passes.
And then for the final finding of fact, like to include ARS 32-2044-14 as outlined in both the initial and supplemental investigative reports.
King, second. Any discussion? Okay, we'll call the vote.
It's been moved and seconded to include finding of fact violations of ARS 32-2044-14 for the reasons set forth in the investigative report as well as the supplemental investigative report. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
And Mr. Barton?
Yes.
That motion passes.
Okay. So at this time, we need to vote on conclusions of law.
Dr. King, members of the board, I think we kind of did that in the other motions where we identified both the statutes and the supporting findings of fact.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sure.
Quick question. On my minutes, can I list findings of facts and conclusions of laws as one?
I think so.
Thank you.
Okay, the board discussing any possible actions.
I definitely would like to get some sort of a documentation review put into place.
Okay. So you're moving along the lines then of disciplinary action?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
I think he's taken an ethics course, but I'm not sure exactly what it covered. So maybe something a little more in-depth, maybe even Pro B.
Yeah, it sounded like it was a fraud, waste, abuse course, and then a home health documentation course, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, let me look and see what the certificates say.
Oh, it looks like home health compliance. And then fraud, waste, and abuse for home health billing.
Okay. How many hours were the documentation?
These are both just compliance related. I'm trying to see if I can find the documentation one. So I believe he mentioned that he also took a documentation course, right?
That was in their initial response, but I'm having a hard time finding it myself.
There are certificates listed in the investigative report on page 31 and 32. That's the original. I'm looking in the supplemental now.
31 and 32.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at.
Okay. Go back.
Yeah, one of them is home health compliance in U for 0.4. CEUs, and then fraud, waste, and abuse for home health billing and field staff, 0.5 CEUs.
Okay. All right. So I'll make a motion that we find that we move him into a disciplinary action where we require, I think, additional documentation. CEUs, we typically like 6 hours. I think that's a minimum, given the significant lack of, at that time at least, understanding of documentation. So 6 hour documentation course. I'd like him to take a 3 hour CEU ethics course. Either can be completed online. I would suggest that they are a 12 months probation. Of course, we can discuss that when we discuss, but 12 months probation, retaking the jurisprudence exam, revisiting supervision, and monitoring no less than 3 charts. By a consultant, not necessarily by the board, approved by the board at the cost of the certificate holder.
Before we have a second on that, I'd be interested to know whether or not what the board feels about restricting his license to on-site supervision. It seems that I don't know. It just doesn't sound right that he's treating up to 11 people in a day, and he's rated at 6 in a day, and there's really no checks and balances at all. So I would like to hear about restricting his license. He still has his certificate, but he's restricted to on-site supervision, perhaps for the duration of the probation.
Any discussion on that?
So, Dr. Cornwell, I have been thinking about that, but I'm not. I'm hesitant to do so just from the perspective of I have some concerns as to how much of that was an issue with Mr. Ladasir and how much of it was an issue with his former employer. And I don't know, because my concerns is sound like it's similar to yours, in that it doesn't seem like there's any way, any kind of monitoring or check or balance on what was happening here. And I would be hesitant to look like we're punishing him for something that was for a lack of supervision by his employer. I mean, I realized that he had the obligation to be ethical regardless of whether he was adequately supervised, but that's kind of my concern. And I don't know that we have heard one way or the other from Mr. Ladasir about the reasons for his withdrawal and his new employment status. And if we're going to do something as severe as restricting his license, I'd like to know if that was part of the corrective action that he's been trying to take. That's my perspective.
Yeah. Okay.
Dr. King, members of the board, kind of balancing Dr. Cornwell's concerns with what just Mr. Barnes just said is that we could ask, you know, it sounds like we're going to have some sort of practice monitor come in and review records. As mm-hmm. part of that, they can ensure that the load level does not exceed 6 per day, consistent with, you know, board statutes and regulations for a PTA. And they can report that back to you in their quarterly reports. And if he is exceeding that, you then retain the jurisdiction to address that issue at that time.
I'm okay with that. I think that's a good idea.
And I can understand where you were going with that too, Dr. Cornwall. So my other question then would be, is there something else that could be put in place with along with the documentation monitoring and the patient kind of load monitoring, where there's a monitoring also in place for how he's approaching each patient treatment? Obviously not every single patient treatment he's going to do over the course of a probation, but every so often going in and, you know, somebody monitoring maybe one patient treatment and seeing how that goes. Is he abiding by statutes? Is he, talking with supervising PT about anything that comes up that needs to be a change to the plan of care? Just different things like that. Is that something that we have, that we would be able to put in place as well?
I would think we would be able to do that along with the, documentation monitoring. This is more like a practice monitoring.
It almost sounds like supervised clinical practice in a way.
It does.
Can part of the monitoring include interview of one of the supervising physical therapists? Would that?
Yeah. I think this is the right way to go, is some type of practice monitoring, because he's admitted that his documentation is so poor, and so there's actually no evidence that we can point to that he's doing things the way he should be doing. So monitoring, I think, is the only way that we're going to get the answer to that.
Yeah.
Is he really talking to his supervising physical therapist every day? Is he contacting him if there's a change in the plan of care? Is he, you know, making sure that he actually charges reasonable for whatever is provided that day? I think patient note monitoring will get to some of that, but not completely.
Right.
So I like the idea of some type of practice monitoring.
I would agree as well.
Yep.
Judy, do you have an idea how to operationalize something like that?
If I could offer, you know, historically, we have had external monitoring agencies around which you have set the parameters. It could be 10 patients randomly selected per month.
Okay.
It could be per week. But you can, based on the findings of fact and conclusions of law ask that the monitor assess his practice, depending on the intensity that you want to select for the boundaries, on a monthly basis. And based on his success with that, then you can do decreasing frequency over time. That's what I've seen in the past.
I like it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I hate to do this, but I need to step out for a moment.
Dr. King, members of the board, would you like to take maybe a two-minute recess?
I have a motion, I think, on the table. I don't know that it was seconded. So would you like me to withdraw it for now and then come back and restate?
Sure.
Just to help kind of make sure that we close the loop.
Sure.
Correctly. Okay, I'll withdraw my initial motion and we'll come back to that after a very brief break.
Okay.
The recording is stopping at 10:37. And we'll be back in, 3 minutes at 10:40?